We are now on item 10. Mr. Monroe.
Okay, good morning. My name is John Monroe. I'm with Siegel Consulting, and I'm here today to present the results of our actual experience study. You should have in your board packet a report that looks like this, but you also should have a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation looks like this. I'll be going through the PowerPoint today. You know, we do an actual experience study every 3 years, and today we're mainly focusing on the demographic assumptions. If you go into slide two of the presentation, what we're looking for is the board to take action with regard to adoption of the proposed demographic assumptions to use in our next actual evaluation as of December 31st, 2015. We're also going to again discuss the recommendation for an explicit administration load, so we're looking for action on that also. There's two types of assumptions. Demographic assumptions, those affect the timing of when the benefits will be payable, like when a member retires, that will start the benefit payments. It also affects the amount of benefits payable. If a member retires with 20 years versus 30 years and so on, that will affect how much benefits are actually paid. Mortality table, how long a person is going to live, that will affect how much benefits are expected to be paid to the member. These are different than the economic assumptions. The economic assumptions were reviewed late April. The board already adopted those assumptions. Slide three here, we talk about termination rates, mortality rates, and so on as rates of decrement. That's opposed as opposed to like an increment. An increment you're probably familiar with is like an increase. A decrement is like a decrease or a reduction. We have assumptions for members, you know, mortality, how long members are going to live, when they're going to die, disability incidence rates, retirement rates, and also termination rates. So there's really four ways an active member can leave active employment, at least under the assumptions in our evaluation. So mortality, disability, retirement, and then finally termination, which covers basically everything else. For termination rates, once a member terminates, we have an assumption whether the member is going to elect a refund of their contributions or whether they will leave their money in the fund and get a deferred annuity. For mortality rates, there's pre-retirement mortality rates while the member is actively employed. There's post-retirement mortality rates. There's disability mortality rates. There could also be mortality rates that apply if you receive a duty, you know, like a duty death or so on. We also have assumptions for the leave cash outs. That's kind of the pay that's received in the final average earnings period of the member right before they retire. So it's pay received in that period that is not received in other periods. We have an assumption for service from unused sick leave conversion. At retirement, members can convert their sick leave and get additional service credits. So we got an assumption for that. We got assumptions for what percent of members are married. We got assumptions for what percent of members go on and work for a reciprocal employer. These demographic assumptions, they can be, we have separate assumptions for general members versus safety members in some instances, like retirement rates. I mean, there's different benefit formulas for general members versus safety members. So we have different retirement rates, so on. Slide four here. These are the economic assumptions. They were already discussed late April and adopted. Just the one comment here. Part of the salary increase assumption we will be talking about today, and that's more the merit and promotional increases, and because those are more specific to the individual based on how many years of service. So we'll be talking about that one today, but the other assumptions, investment return, inflation, and real wage increases, those were already adopted in late April by the board. Slide five here. The main thing I want to hit on this slide is when we're looking at demographic assumptions, we look like in this study, we looked at mainly the last 3 years, like how many members retired at age 65 or for example. And we really, for demographic assumptions, we really look closely at the recent experience and adjust our assumption as necessary. That's in contrast to the economic assumptions where, you know, when we set the investment return assumption, we don't look at what actually happened in the last 3 years and use that to set our return assumption. I mean, our return assumption would be all over the place. So, but demographic assumptions, we definitely look at what happened last 3 years and incorporate that into our assumption going forward. Slide six, cover this later at the end of the presentation after we talk about some of the impacts. Slide seven, so now we're going to talk about how we set a demographic assumption. So what we do is we look at, during the last 3 years, we look at, for example, how many members were age 65 and that could have actually retired, okay? So let's say there's 100 of them. So we got 100 members age 65, they could have retired during the last 3 years. That's what we call the exposures. That's the number of people who could have retired, for example. Then we look at the what we call the decrements, and that's how many people that actually retired at age 65. So let's say there was 40 of them during the period. We then take, you know, 40 divided by 100, and we get our actual retirement rate of 40% at age 65 during that period. We'll then compare that 40% to our current assumption, and then we'll make adjustments depending on how credible we think the experience is and so on. So that's basically what we're doing here. And on slide eight, we have an example here. There's probably more than 30 of these graphs in that blue book, and I'll just be covering this one here. This is a retirement rate graph. And all the graphs in the report, they look similar, where the red line is the current assumption, and the green is the actual experience, and the blue is the proposed. So this is a retirement rate assumption for General Tier 3. And what we can see in the early years is the lines are all pretty much mashed on top of each other, which is good, because that means that the actual experience was near the current experience. So the green line was near the red line. So the blue line, we didn't need to move that much, at least in the early years here. Now you can see, for example, around ages 62 to 64, the red line, the green line came in below the red line, so we moved the blue line down a little bit around ages 62, 63 there. So that's the type of thing that we're doing here. You'll notice at the end of the graph, at least from ages 65 to 69 and all the way out to 74, the graph is a lot more rough looking. It's kind of all over the place. And we didn't move our blue line, our proposed, to go exactly on top of that green line for a few reasons. Around ages 65 to 69, it goes up and then it goes down the green line. We kind of smooth that out with our blue line. And then way at the end of this graph, for instance, like age 74, there's a 0% retirement rate. I mean, there was only 9 people age 74 during the 3-year period that were eligible to retire. None of them retired. Age 73, another example, there were 9 people age 73 during the period. 2 of them retired, and that's how you get a 22% rate. So there's those ending ages, there's really just not a lot of people. So we don't fully go to the experience that's shown there. But this is kind of what we're doing throughout the report with retirement rates, termination rates, and stuff like that. Slide 9 here. So here's our recommendations for a lot of the demographic assumptions. Retirement rates, we're recommending, based on the experience during the 3-year period, slightly later retirements for general members, slightly earlier retirements for safety members. On the termination rates, we're recommending an increase in the termination rates. And when a member terminates, we're going to continue our assumption that the member will elect either a refund of contributions or a deferred annuity based on which one is more valuable. So that will continue. Disability incidence rates, we're recommending decreases for general members, increases for safety members. And then on the leave cash outs, for most of the cost groups, we're recommending decreases in the leave cash out assumption. Keep in mind that experience is still pretty hypothetical because experience study goes through the end of 2014. So we did collect data based on the retirements during that period, but as if the AB 197 and the no steroidaline applied to them. So that's still pretty hypothetical, but we're recommending decreases. In future years, we'll have real, more live, actual experience on that assumption. And then on the sick leave, overall, we're recommending decreases on that assumption. Again, these are all based on the experience during the three-year period.
John, on the sick leave, if you're taking the position that of slightly later retirements, and that would assume slightly greater possible accruals of sick leave, but what you're seeing is a greater use of sick leave while employed?
Well, general members are retiring later, but we're seeing less sick leave. For whatever reason.
When they retire.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing. Yeah, for at least for general members. Yep. Safety members, we're seeing earlier retirements. Mm-hmm.
Taking advantage of it.
The sick leave is not a large number by any means. It's a pretty small assumption. I mean, I think the loads are around 1% or something like that. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, then slide 10 here. So this is really the big topic for today. And it's in regards to the mortality assumption, and we did, you know, we talked about this 3 years ago. We mentioned, you know, people are living longer. We continue to find that on a lot of our systems. People are just living longer, and you know, the side of actuaries, they created a retirement plans experience committee to review mortality experience recently. And in 2014, they released a new mortality table. It's called the RP 2014 mortality table. So that's happened. And they've also published some mortality improvement scales. So the used to be scale AA. It was started around 2000. That scale does not reflect enough mortality improvement. It understates mortality improvement. So then there was a new scale BB that was released. Then in 2014, with that new mortality table, there was a new mortality improvement scale released called the scale MP 2014. But even a year later, they found that this scale overstates mortality improvement. So then they issued another scale, okay, and that was in 2015. And that's the scale MP 2015. So there's been some new mortality tables come out, new mortality improvement scales come out. And slide 11 here, so there's kind of two ways to do this. Historically, we've projected mortality improvement on a static basis. And kind of basically what that means is, you know, we used like the RP 2000 mortality table, and we projected mortality improvement to the year 2030, but we didn't project it any farther than that. And what we would do is, so we had mortality improvement in our assumption, we usually wanted to have at least actual deaths exceed our expected deaths by about 10%. That'd be like a 10% margin. But what would happen is every 3 years we'd do our study, people are living longer, that margin be gone, we have to put it back in. And so recent thinking is that we should put in a bigger margin, maybe 20%, but what we're recommending here today actually goes a step further, okay? So we're recommending a change to what's called generational mortality, and that's on slide 12 here. And let me just try to go through a simple example to explain the difference between static and generational mortality. With static mortality, for each member, we need to know whether they're male or female, and then we need to know how old they are. And then we can, then based on that, we can value them in our valuation. But with generational mortality, we need to know whether they're male or female. We need to know how old they are. But we also need to know what year they're born, okay? Because under static mortality, let's say retirement, the probability, let's say 4 out of 100 retirees are assumed to die at age 65. Well, that stays constant, that 4 out of 100, whether you're age 65 in 2016 or you're age 65 in 2026 or 2036 or so on. So that's static mortality. So that 4% mortality rate applies to a person age 65, no matter whether it's this year or 50 years in the future. So that's static mortality. Now, generational mortality, we'd start off with that 4 out of 100 retirees dying in 2016. But in 2026, an age 65 retiree, maybe it's only 3 out of 100 are assumed to die. So over time, in future years, with generational mortality, you will get more mortality improvement. And the mortality rates, again, depend not only on your sex and your year of birth. They depend on your, they depend not only on whether you're male or female or your age. They also depend on what year you were born. So if you're 65 now versus 65 20 years from now, you will have a different reduced mortality rate 20 years from now. So that's really how generational mortality works. So we're recommending use of the RP 2014 mortality table, the newer mortality table, with the MP 2015 mortality improvement scale. So basically, we'll be projecting mortality improvement over each and every year in the future for every single member, even a new hire that comes in. So that's really kind of how generational mortality works. We'll be applying, if approved, we'll be applying that in the valuation. Two other small things to note about this. Safety members are living longer than general members. That continues to be true, so we use a little bit different table for them. And when we calculate the member contribution rates for the legacy tiers, you know, those tables in the back of the report that are by entry age, and when we go to calculate optional benefits and reserves, there we can't really use a generational mortality table, so we use a static mortality table that's projected 20 years. That approximates the generational mortality table. So, and the main reason is, you know, those tables, they depend right now on mainly your age at hire, you know, whether you're entered at 20 or 30 or so on. If we tried to use generational mortality table on those member rate tables, then we would not only need to know when you were hired, but also, you know, what age you were hired, but also what year you were hired in. We would get too many tables. People would not be able to find their member rate. So that's...
Did you just say safety members live longer than general members?
Yes, that's correct.
That's what the setback is.
Yes.
Thanks. I'm shocked about that.
No, I'm really surprised.
John, are you talking about they live longer in retirement or they live longer as just...
Age. They live longer.
They just live longer.
It's age.
Good news.
Says the safety member.
It destroys the PR campaign that was used for years, though.
No, I'm just very surprised because I'm always hearing they don't have as long a lifespan, and therefore a higher retirement is justified because there's more wear and tear in their bodies, and they're going to have a much shorter lifespan.
Correct. That's what you've heard.
Yeah, I mean, there could be a lot of things at play. I mean, safety members retire at earlier ages. Maybe that helps them live longer. I don't know. I mean, they could be healthier. I mean, they're...
good news for safety members, but it's just very interesting.
Yeah. And I've found this on other systems, too. Yeah.
That's right. You should be.
So, John, is the use of the static mortality table that you just described the state of the practice, is that an accepted practice? Is that done elsewhere? Mm-hmm.
For just the member rates or just for the valuation in general?
As you just described it for us.
Well, right now we're using a static, the current assumption is a static mortality table used in the valuation. So yes, that is still what I think what you asked, if that was a reasonable assumption.
I'm asking if that's state of the practice.
That is practice used by many systems currently. That's right.
Is it the state of the actuarial practice? I'm trying to understand this, your science. Is that the state of your practice?
Well, the emerging practice is to move to generational mortality table.
Are you doing that for other systems?
Yes. But you are one of the first two systems we are recommending this for. Mm-hmm. But there are other systems that are not our clients in California that have also adopted this practice.
Have you recommended this to another 37 Act system in California prior to this?
Not yet, but that is partially just due to the timing of when the experience studies are done and so on.
And one thing to think about with generational mortality is that there might be a tendency to think that it's a once and done type of item. It's not. You know, if the board were to go for generational mortality, there in future actuarial assumption studies, we would be possibly tweaking it some, but maybe not as much as if we stayed with the static mortality. that
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, in prior years, we use a static mortality, the margin's gone, then we got to put the margin back in, and it's somewhat, you know, it could be a big tweak. The generational, it's going to adjust over time. If mortality improvement follows the mortality improvement scale that we're using with the generational mortality, then we will not ever need to make a change in the future. But most likely, we will just need to make, hopefully, just small tweaks in the future.
Mm-hmm.
John, can you talk for a minute about the headcount weighted versus the benefit weighted and
sure.
why you're not recommending the benefit weighted?
Yep. So with this new mortality table, there's actually two versions of it. One is called headcount weighted. One is called benefit weighted. So the headcount weighted, that's the version we're recommending use of. And basically, each person counts as one or the same weight. Everybody counts as the same weight no matter what their benefit is, no matter whether their benefit's $100 a month or $5,000 a month. So every person, every body is counted equally. So there's another version that's called the benefit weighted, and that takes into account people's pensioners' benefit amounts, okay? So that what they found is that people with higher benefits may live longer. Okay, maybe they have more access to, you know, health benefits or stuff like that, you know. But the reason we don't want to go, and that does make some sense, but the reason right now we don't want to go to the benefit weighted is a lot of that data was based on corporate plans, okay? And corporate pension plans, you know, you have a bunch of people that have about the same benefit, and then the CEO has like 10 times the benefit, okay? So right now I think on the benefit weighted we want to wait until there's another study being done with more public sector plan data, and a new mortality table will be hopefully developed in a few years, and then we will look at that table in a few years and see if the benefit weighted is appropriate for public sector pension plan use as compared to how it was developed off of corporate pension plan use.
My reaction is that it sounds like the benefit weighted approach would more accurately, you know, more accurately depict the liability. I guess you're saying that the basis for the current model is premised on private plans. Is that it?
That's generally true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Generally true. I mean.
Yeah. No. It's true. It's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
Mm-hmm. John, this is something new to me. Let me just ask to go through it one more time. My experience in how you value pension plans is each individual has his or her benefit projected against salary scale and against expected retirement dates and against all of the various assumptions and decrements that we just got through talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And then the benefit expected to be paid in each future year up to age 110, the old days, is discounted back to a present value.
Yep.
You don't do that?
No, I would say we do that. Okay,
so
yeah.
Isn't that benefit weighted? Is the benefit is determined for each individual?
Well, I would say the extra thing we do is the mortality rate will could depend on your benefit amount. Higher benefit amount will be lower mortality rate.
Thank you.
That's benefit weighted. Higher benefit is lower mortality rate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay. So my reaction to that earlier was that sounds to me, for whatever reason, maybe it is better access to healthcare. Who knows what the reason is?
Yeah.
But if that's what's actually occurring, isn't that a more accurate approach?
It could be. Yeah, I guess, and I'm fine with that approach. If the board wants to adopt the benefit weight, I'm very fine with that approach. Okay, I think that just the way the data was developed was more based on corporate plans where, again, you know, we got a bunch of people with, you know, kind of smaller benefits, and then we got the CEOs with the huge benefits and a public sector plan. I mean, you know, the other thing is in this corporate plan, you know, public sector plan like this plan, I mean, people are retiring thousands of dollars of benefits per month. Corporate plans are quite a bit different. Okay, I mean, there's a bunch of people getting 800, and then there's one person getting 8,000 a month. Okay,
apparently he's living or she's living longer.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. But there is yeah, I mean, there is, I can see some merit to that approach, though. I mean, people with more money, yeah, they may have more access to health care and stuff like that.
Well, you know, for whatever, and to me, I don't know what the myriad reasons are. Who knows? But yeah. If that's, in fact, what's occurring, I guess that's what's most important for us to know.
Well, that's occurring in the corporate data they use to develop that benefit weighted table. That's right.
So I'm just trying to, you know, just in theory, trying to understand the difference between corporate employees and public agency employees.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I does it depend on lifestyles then? What's the determining factor?
Well, yeah, it could be a lot of things. I mean, it could depend on the area they live on. I mean, I think, you know, California, I think the mortality is ahead of a lot of the rest of the nation, more healthy lifestyle and stuff like that. So this is a lot of factors.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question, Don. So, you know, they're conducting this study of public sector plans, and in a few years they're going to be coming back with something. Is there a sense of, okay, what we're looking at today, is there going to be a large variance in the future? I mean, I know, you know, you have a crystal ball up there and you can predict accurately what's going to happen, but I mean, is there a general sense?
Well, I don't think there is. I think it's unknown. The one thing I will say is that mortality table that we started off with, the RFP 2014, it matches the Contra Costa, it matches your retirement plans experience through, you know, 2014, basically exactly. I mean, we can start off with that base table and it matches your mortality experience. So, I mean, based on that, we may not find much difference with the public sector mortality.
Okay. Well, it's all clear to me.
You're going to live forever.
Yeah.
Live to 150.
You've got to figure that out. Yeah.
Are you a safety member?
Okay. Not yet, but I'm thinking about it.
John, you just mentioned the 2014 table, but I thought earlier you mentioned the recommendation was the 2015.
Well, we're going to, the mortality table is as of 2014. Okay, so that mortality table, there's like, you know, from age 20 to 120, there's a bunch of, you know, mortality rates for each and every age. Then the mortality improvement scale, that's from 2015. That takes those mortality rates and reduces them over time for future mortality improvement. So it's the RP 2014 mortality table with the MP 2015 mortality improvement scale.
Okay, so there's not a 2015 table?
Nope. They changed the scale, but not the table. That's right.
This is on purpose to make it as confusing as possible,
yes.
By the way.
Yes, of course. Oh, man.
Slide 13 here. I mean, all we're really showing here on the right is that we, you know, we set the expected deaths. That's the blue bar. Basically equal to the actual to begin with. That's kind of how we start out. And then over time, the mortality improvement scale will reduce the mortality rates, and that's how we'll reflect the future mortality improvement. So that's how this works. Okay, one on slide 14, just on the promotional merit salary increases is the last demographic assumption. Board already adopted the price inflation and the real wage. So the price inflation is 2.75, the real wage growth is a half, so that's 3.25, and then we'll add to it a promotional and merit salary increase assumption. That assumption depends on the years of service. When you start out, you get much higher promotional merit increase as compared to later years in your career. And we did look at the experience during the last 3 years, and we are recommending some increases in the promotional and merit salary increase assumption. Usually what happens is in periods of low inflation, then when we look at this assumption, basically most of the salary increase, it appears as being a promotional merit because there just really wasn't much inflation. So that's kind of why part of the reason why we're recommending increases in this assumption. So that's the demographic assumptions. And then Want to touch on this explicit administration load assumption again. That's on slide 15 here. And so for funding purposes, when we do the valuation, where we calculate the contribution rates that the employers will pay and the members will pay, the 7% assumption, investment return assumption, it is net of both administrative and investment expenses. That's been historical practice. That's still the current practice. Now, for GASB reporting, we have to use an assumption that's net of investment expenses but gross of administrative expenses. So if we still use a 7% assumption there, but that assumption is gross of administrative expenses. So this was first discussed back in April 2014. The board elected to continue the current structure for funding, which is net of, again, investment and administrative expenses, but wanted to bring that action back. I think you guys spoke about it in late April, and now finally we're bringing it back again here. And, you know, on slide 16 here, So for funding and financial reporting, we use the same 7% assumption, just one is net of both investment and administrative expenses. The other one for financial reporting for GASB is net of investment expenses only. So really what we're looking for is for, we're making a recommendation to set the assumption for funding to be net of investment expenses only and not net of administrative expenses, and then we would create an explicit administrative expense load. There's a few reasons we think we should do that. Slide 17 here. So, you know, if you look at the plan's financial statement, you see, you know, $7 million in administrative expenses being paid. I mean, that seems pretty clear, pretty transparent. But what is not transparent is how much contributions are actually collected to fund those administrative expenses. Okay, it's not even easy for me to calculate the way that it's currently done. I mean, those administrative expenses, $7 million, they represent about 11 basis points. So we when we develop that 7% return assumption and we have all those components, there's a reduction of 11 basis points for the administrative expenses. Now, if we go into our Val software and change by 11 basis points our return assumption, it actually changes the contributions by about $12 million a year. So it's hard to know exactly what contributions are being funded to cover those administrative expenses. It's also not clear exactly how much is paid by the members and how much is paid by the employers on slide 18 here. What we'd like to move to is more of an explicit approach where we set an assumption for the administrative expenses, and it'll be about equal to $7 million. It'll actually be set equal to 1% of payroll, and that's $7 million. And then we would allocate that, as is shown on the bottom of page 18, 77 basis points to employers, 23% to members. That tries to approximate how it's currently being implicitly funded right now. So we want to set, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
So, would you say that these administrative expenses are a part of normal cost?
No, nope, nope. And I think I know why you're bringing that. Yeah. So, they would be separate from normal cost. We do got to be careful about the PEPRA 50-50 sharing. That's one thing. But these would be separate from normal cost. That's correct. Mm-hmm. So we want to set up an explicit administrative expense load. It'd be 1% of payroll. It'd be about $7 million a year. We could then see that we're funding $7 million a year instead of the non-transparent way that's going on right now where we're just, it's just it's baked into the return assumption, all the numbers are changed by 11 basis points, and nobody really knows exactly how much we're funding. So that's really what we're looking for here. On slide 19,
before you go mm-hmm, on mm-hmm. how many other systems are doing it this way as opposed to the way we're doing it?
Well, I looked at the 2037 Act systems, and actually right now it's a deadlock tie, 10 and 10.
Okay.
Okay, so 10 are doing it the way you're currently doing it. 10 are using the explicit administrative expense load.
Is there a trend?
Well, there's definitely been a trend moving towards the explicit administration expense load because, you know, the new GASB rules came out, and that's what really caught our attention here. Not to say that GASB should affect how you fund the plan, but that's really where it came about. And the other thing I'll say is if we were setting up this plan new or doing the first valuation, nowadays we would have set up an explicit administrative expense load. We would not have done the way that it's historically been done probably for the last, 50 years or who knows. So
then how do you come up with the 77.23%? How does the employers, where does that come from?
Well, we look at the contribution rates for the employers and the members without the expense load.
Uh-huh.
So right now the employers are paying about 77% of the cost of the pension plan on average. So that's how we came up with.
And then, but will that be shifting with PEPRA as we have more PEPRA members coming in? And then would you be shifting this number?
Yeah.
Each year?
Yeah, the number would shift automatically each year.
Based upon the contribution.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It would shift automatically each year. The assumption would be initially set at 1% of payroll, but the allocation could shift each year a little bit.
Again, as I'm looking at the hit to the employers, I want to understand fully why they're absorbing the 77%, and this is a helpful way to look at it, as well as going forward that will change depending upon what shifts.
It'll probably slowly change.
Well, I don't see a big change, but again, if we get to a point where I think with Debbie talking about normal costs, shifting a little bit with PEPRA as well. I'm just trying to see where we
Right, it would shift this loading over time. Yep, that's right.
$7 million, is it tracked? Let's say 1 year we go $6 million or $8 million. Is it, what do you do with that?
Well, so our assumption will be 1% of payroll, and let's say 1% of payroll, $7 million. Okay, so we'll collect $7 million in contributions. Now the fund will pay out whatever it's going to actually pay out. Could be six, could be eight, like you said. We will get a gain or loss, like we do on every other assumption that gets put into the valuation and put into the costs, recognized over 18, amortized over 18 years. But every 3 years, we will review this assumption again. Yeah, so, I mean, payroll generally goes up over time. I mean, administrative expenses generally probably go up over time. So there will be some automatic adjusting there, but we will look at this every 3 years. Maybe it shouldn't be 1%. Maybe it should be 1.2. Maybe it should be 1.1. But just like every other assumption, we review it every 3 years.
So it sort of seems as though we would be moving to a system where once, say, 1% of payroll, that would become our budget in order to achieve the nirvana, so to speak, of not having any gains or losses due to this item, that we would want, for budgeting purposes of our administrative cost, to say, we're assuming 1% of payroll. Our budget should reflect 1% of payroll.
Well, I'm not necessarily going there. Okay, I'm just saying
for
the.
Make sense?
Well, I'm focused on our valuation and how it gets funded. So I look at history and whatever it was, and then I set up the assumption. I mean, there could be other things that could drive your budget. Maybe you got to hire extra people. Maybe you got to get us a bunch of computers. I don't know, but yeah.
Okay, but to come up with the 1% number that we're starting with, did we actually do this calculation of what our administrative costs have been over the last 3 years?
That's right.
And compare
that's how
that
it's
to
developed.
Payroll?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the payroll, employer payroll, operates independently from assets in the system that need to be administered, or so it's. It's a way to collect for the payment, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the demands of our budget.
But if that's what we're going to assume, is 1% of payroll is our administrative cost, I would expect our budget to reflect a tie to that as at least our target.
Is that like another meeting, though?
It's actually kind of high, I think.
It is.
Really.
Let's see, was that off
what we're actually spending, but right. If that's the best estimate.
Well, I mean, he just said that he looked at the last 3 years, and that's what he came up with. And if it's a high target, we should determine that now and try to make an actual real target. And I mean, I just think the two should mesh, or, you know, the two targets should be the same. If we're going to assume that administrative expenses are 1% of payroll for purposes of collecting contributions, we should also have that assumption in our budgeting of what we spend.
Again, this is not on the agenda. I'm not disagreeing or agreeing.
Well, I know it's not on the agenda, but it ties into, do we have a realistic assumption?
And he's saying we did based on what he's reviewed. It's close to $7 million.
I mean, you could have
He said we don't.
You could have the employers hire, you know, give, you know, 10% raises across the board, and that's going to affect payroll. That's going to affect the amount that we collect on it. Our budget may stay the same or may go down. So it's... In setting the amount, I agree, you have to look at what our expenses are, right?
Historically, that's right.
But I think that we've never hit $7 million as far as our annual budget, right? We have?
Yeah, we have.
Okay.
What was last year? What was 2015?
I don't remember offhand.
I can look it up.
But if you go back 3 years, each time you do this, we've got a running experience level that we are approximately aiming for in the assumption. It'll come out a little higher, a little lower, but it adjusts every 3 years based on actual experience. So
I think that the methodology is fine, but I want to make sure that we've got consistent targets across the two things.
But the numbers that he's picking up are based on our actual expenses. Mm-hmm. Our actual expenses shouldn't be based on what he's collecting. They should be based on what our needs are.
But our target for what we're collecting should be based on what our needs are.
But it's always going to be looking backwards and not looking forward. Like if we were going to put in a whole new computer system next year, it's not going to be reflected in what he's going to set as the experience for the last 3 years. So we're always going to be a year or 3 years behind.
Mm-hmm.
So then we're going to be experiencing losses.
Or maybe not, maybe
for being
profits.
Behind.
Yeah.
It can go either way.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I'd say if we had an experience that went like this, you might want to look at it annually as opposed to every 3 years. I mean, that would presumably be something we could do if that were necessary. My sense is it's been a fairly steady progression.
Yeah.
As we've grown, we've added bodies, we've added positions, we've added...
Well, we've always targeted a percentage of assets.
That's been
the limitation. For the budget.
That's the limitation, right.
That's what we've targeted for the budget, but it would seem to me that we should be targeting the same thing. What
so the 2015 budget was $9 million, and then the 2016 budget was $9.2 million.
Right. So we're starting with $7 million. Is that what we're starting with?
Based on the 14 valuation, we're starting with about $7 million. Now, whatever the payroll is in the 15 valuation, we will actually apply the 1% to. So it'll probably be a little bit higher than $7 million. But that's what we're starting off with. Yep.
Payroll's actually gone up from 14 to 15.
Right. So I mean, if I were going to set an assumption, I really prefer to use current information. And the current information we have is $9.6 million is our 2016 budget. We should be dividing that by the payroll in 2016. Maybe looking at 15 as well. And it seems as though we used a number from 2014.
Well, we looked at 2012, 13, and 14 and averaged them. I would also be careful about just sending off 1 year, unless we're going to actually look at it every year. You know, I mean, also, let's keep in mind, this is 7 or 8 or $9 million out of a, you know, multi-billion dollars of pension plan, you know. So again, we're just trying to make it a little more transparent how it's funded, approximate it, so on.
I mean, I would caution about linking the two. I mean, I think it's a good reference point and something we definitely need to keep in mind, but I wouldn't want the plan to feel like, oh, we can't get a new administration system because it's going to pop us up over, you know. I think it's I think, and I personally like the explicit rate because you're putting it out there, you're acknowledging, you know, this is what we're doing, every 3 years we'll take a look at it. I mean, right now it's so embedded, it's even, like John said, it's hard to even see the employer-employee right. split. So
I think I would agree with the implicit rate. I just think that we should be using current, you know, I mean, we used 2012 to 2014 to develop the rate. We really should be using 2013 to 16. That's the best information we have. So that's my concern.
You know, again, when this rate is applied, it's going to be 18 months later.
Exactly.
Anyway,
It'll be another 18 months later, which is even more reason why we should
really
use current.
Our current budget to what we're going to be collecting, you know, beginning 18 months going forward. So, I mean, again, be conscious of what we're collecting, but that shouldn't be what our budget is limited to. Our budget is limited to the statutory limitation.
Yeah, and see, that's where I would differ. And I think our budget should be limited to assumptions that we make. If we're going to make assumptions on one hand, for these calculations that the administrative costs are this, we should be trying to at least target that on the other side with what we spend.
But you've just, I mean, the last 3 years it's been seven, or average seven.
Right.
The last two,
so we should
it's
average
been,
the
it's
last
been nine.
We so. Should be looking at 16, 15, and 14 is my opinion.
Karen, have a comment? I'm sorry, Karen.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, John. For Sarah's budget and expenses, there is a statute in the about that that sets the cap.
Mm-hmm.
There's administrative expenses, which are capped, and there's the non-administrative expenses, such as actuarial and legal and investment expenses. What I'm not understanding so much is the tie-in between actual expenses and payroll. That.
Well,
allocation method.
Yeah, I mean, we look at the actual expenses in dollars over the last few years, and then we look at them as a percent of payroll. I mean, all contributions are collected as a percent of payroll. That's really the only reason here that we're going to express the $7 million or whatever it is as a percent of payroll, because we're going to collect it as a percent of payroll.
Mm-hmm. So it's a way to determine. Based on comparing the current expenses to payroll and coming up with a percentage, and then applying that going forward.
Converting them to a percent of pay and applying that percent of pay, just like we apply the other rates as a percent of pay. That's right. I mean, you could take $7 million. You could divide it by, you know, I mean, there's other ways to do it. I don't think they would make as much sense, but yes, just like the other rates, these are calculated as a percent of payroll. Mm-hmm. And these administrative expenses, they do include the actual fees and so on. These are the full administrative expenses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Oh, sure.
I just want to clarify the allocation between employer and employee. You're taking their rates that they're paying those contributions on, which for the employer includes their UAL piece.
Right. That's right. So that's
what I think Deborah was saying. The normal cost piece, where we allocated it based on the employer normal and the employee normal. This would be a different allocation.
That's right. These are based on the total rates, including normal cost and unfunded liability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was actually my next question, is that we are basically asking the employer to pay for a heavier burden of the administrative costs because the unfunded, only because we have such a high unfunded liability. If we had zero unfunded liability, we would be sitting here talking about splitting that cost 50-50 between the employer and the employee.
Pretty close. That's correct. And we're doing this allocation because we're also trying to sort of mimic what's going on currently. Because currently, again, it's being implicitly funded. It's buried in all those numbers, unfunded liability, normal cost, member rate right now. So we're just trying to roughly reproduce how it's done right now, just with an explicit load.
Okay.
side, other agencies do it with the combined UALL as well. They don't split it out via normal costs?
Not that I've seen.
This is a new, relatively new phenomenon,
right?
Trying
to get a grasp because, again...
Well, half the systems.
Half the systems do it. And again, I think most of those do what I'm describing here. Mm-hmm.
And but correct me if I'm wrong, we really have come to this point of having to make this decision. The rest of those systems, did they make that decision really in the last year?
Yep, last few years, yep.
It's mm-hmm. a new issue.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's my question.
Okay, so I'm going to just close here on slide 20 with the cost impact. So the report and this slide shows the cost impact of the proposed demographic assumption changes. It also includes the impact of the already adopted economic assumption changes, and it includes the impact of this proposed administration expense load. So we went back to the last valuation. We plugged in all these changes, would increase the actual accrued liability about $87 million for the entire plan. The average employer rate would go up about 2.46% of payroll. You can see the breakdown here. That's mostly due to the change, proposed change to the mortality assumption. And now the impacts do vary by cost groups. So general cost groups, the impact is around 1 to 2% of pay. Safety cost groups, the impact is higher. It's more about 5 to 7% of pay. And that's, again, because safety members are living longer, they're retiring earlier, and there's also more safety disabilities. So that's why there's kind of a difference in the cost impact there. So this is employer impact, page slide 20. Member impact, slide 21, about an increase about 9 basis points. So most of these, when you combine all this stuff together, most of the change affects the accrued liability, not the normal cost. So since members are only paying normal cost, that's why member rates are not changing as much as employer rates. You can see the breakdown. Again, a lot of it's due to mortality. There is some variation in the member rate impact. One thing I want to, most tiers is pretty small, near the 9 basis points, but for a few tiers, it is a little bit bigger member rate impact, especially the tiers that have a 2% COLA, and that's because when the price inflation assumption was lowered to 2.75, that also affects our COLA assumed for the 3% COLA tiers. We're able to lower the COLA from 3 to 2.75. But the safety tier C and the PEPRA tier E safety tier, they only have a 2% COLA. So when you have 2.75 price inflation and you got a 2% maximum COLA, we don't change the COLA assumption for the 2% COLA tier. So they didn't get the reduction in the COLA assumption that the 3% COLA tiers received. So I think that concludes the presentation at this point.
John, if you deferred the explicit administrative expenses allocation recommendation for the pending the next 3-year period, would your 3-year experience study be 2015, 16, and 17?
The next experience study covers 2015, 16, and 17.
Would that data set be a more accurate and reliable way to present the administrative expenses in terms of transparency versus using a number that's based on experience from 12, 13, and 14?
Well, if we were to, are you saying if we were to delay it until the next experience study?
Well, I said defer it.
Defer.
I saw a difference in those terms. I'm just saying if you deferred that breakout until the next experience study and use the data set of 2015, 16, and 17, would that, for transparency purposes, be a more accurate depiction of what that expense load is and how it's allocated?
I would say not necessarily, because, I mean, right now we're looking back about 3 years. Well, 3 years from now, we would just look back 3 years. So, I mean, if we were to defer it to 2017, I mean, we'd still be looking back 3 years, okay? So it would still be historical.
Oh, I get that, but okay. I think we identified a delta currently
$2 million.
Between 12, 13, and 14 and what the current case is for budget, yes?
Yeah, I mean, maybe what you're saying is back to, should we set the assumption based on what's being budgeted? Maybe, is that where you're going?
Well, I'm not going anywhere. I'm trying to figure out what's the most I'm trying to figure out what's the most accurate for purposes of transparency. I mean, I want to know why you're making the recommendation you're making and what the paramount interest is.
Well, we're making the recommendation because we think that setting an explicit expense load results in more transparency on how the expenses are funded. Right now, it's not clear how the expenses are funded.
The expenses were still there.
I understand. I'm just trying to, you know, I'm trying to understand what the end game goal is in terms of what we're trying to accomplish using the numbers we're going to use for this purpose. That's all. Right. So I guess the question to Gail is, in terms of preference, in terms of direction, what's your thought on this particular item?
I think my preference would be that we have the explicit rate assumption in there, and in 3 years we'll take a look and see what our experience has been. We'll see what payroll changes might happen over the next few years. You know, I think the actual expenses for 2015 are in the 8-something range, which is a little different than the $7 million that John has mentioned. But I think for transparency, I think it's something that we should definitely consider doing at this point. Even though knowing, and this is me knowing what's gonna come ahead in the next few years as far as system needs and that kind of thing, I think it's something that for good transparency, it would be something that I would prefer us doing.
Okay.
Knowing that on down the road, you know, there might be some tweaks in 3 years that we need to do with this.
Okay.
So you mentioned $9.6 million is the 2016
$9.2 million.
Do you see that going down in 2017, 18, 19?
I don't know at this point.
I
don't know that, because this year we're under that. So going forward, whether we come back next year with 9.2, you know.
I don't think I've ever seen our budgeted expenses go down in any of the almost five years I've been here.
Has payroll gone down, though, either? Because payroll is going to be increasing.
I think that's Debbie's point. We're not going to be going backwards.
No. I'm talking payroll by which the contributions are.
So what do you think 1% of 2016 payroll will be? You haven't guessed on that.
They've assumed
we have a half year left. I'm not really.
Yeah, the expected payroll for 15 was about $700 million. But I mean, an initial look at the new data shows, I mean, there was quite a few, I think, new hires in the county and so on. So the payroll will go up, at least in our new valuation that we produce in the next month.
John, is there a distinction in the numbers you get between budget and actually spent? Because I know it's been a while since I've looked at it and recalling it carefully, but I know in earlier years we spent a lot less than our budget.
I'm talking about our expected budget.
we would have huge savings.
Yeah.
Stated savings because people weren't hired that were anticipated and equipment not purchased that wasn't. So what number are we actually talking about here?
We're looking at actual. I've never looked at budgeted.
All right.
I mean, 2014 actual administrative expenses, $6.98 million. Okay. Well, no, this is. I believe this number, we've included the actual fees and stuff like that and so on. Yep. 6.98, I think.
So effectively, we're always lagging.
And
on a rising environment, we're always going to be a little behind using the current method.
So the number I asked you for earlier for 2015 that you gave me was 8-something. Was that actual or was that budgeted?
Well, it's 8-something. The 8-something is going to be the actual,
right.
And then the budget was $9 million. So last year we're under budget,
but it was still
this
eight,
year we're tracking
it was
still
under
8
budget million or something or so.
Yeah,
eight plus. Not 7.
Yeah.
And that 8 plus will be the number John looks at when actually we have the
in
next.
In three years from now. But what I see is we're already at a loss.
A little.
Yeah. And I don't think that's what, I mean, I think when we're setting assumptions, this is one of the problems that we have encountered over and over in the pension system over for years. And that's why we have a big part of why we have an unfunded liability the way at the size that we do is assumptions, right? We take a loss because we don't meet assumptions. But if we're sitting here today and we have information today that we're already going to pick a number that produces a loss, to me that isn't what we're here for. We're here to make valid assumptions for today going forward.
Have we reached the point, John, from your point of view, that it's time for a motion?
Yep.
Okay. Debbie, do you want to propose a motion that incorporates